around the Earth, north, south, east, and west. So it would be an omnidirectional, horizontally polarized antenna. That's not the way people use the loop antennas very well. Quite often the plane of the loop is perpendicular to the Earth, and now it radiates in the plane of the loop, so that if I set the plane of the loop east-west, you're going to be radiating maximum vertically polarized signal to the east and to the west. You will be also emitting you could call it a horizontally polarized signal, straight up and straight down. So depending on who you're talking to with near vertical incident skywave with a loop antenna, I'm now recommending that you set it up the plane perpendicular to the Earth, and as you change its orientation, you will favor the particular guy you want to talk to, whether he be north of you or west of you, so to speak. So I was dead wrong on that one. I expected to be getting some nasty notes. I didn't. And either people don't want to challenge me, or they're not quite sure. What's really going on is we all have very little familiarity with loop antennas. And we're all slowly learning. So I've told you guys quite often, nobody bats a thousand. That's another beautiful example of it. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this subject, loop antennas, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet.
VDH with a comment.
Mr. VDH, go right ahead. And because I'm so darn forgetful, please tell me your name again.
Yeah, fine, this is Dick Head. The name is John, and the complete call is WA2VDH. I was just wondering, how does this work out with the halo antennas that used to be pretty popular during the late 60s for 6 meters? I remember seeing quite a few of those halo antennas that people used on 6 meters.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, John. And that's another example of a loop antenna with the loop laid, the plane of the loop parallel to the Earth. It emits a horizontally polarized signal, very close to omnidirectional. The reason it's omnidirectional is that the circumference of the loop is a fairly small fraction of a wavelength. As the circumference of the loop gets smaller and smaller in wavelength, you know, a third of a wavelength, a quarter of a wavelength, an eighth of a wavelength in circumference. As it gets smaller and smaller, the amount of current flowing around the perimeter of that loop becomes closer and closer to constant. Therefore, it becomes closer and closer to omnidirectional. As you make the loop larger and larger in diameter, and therefore the loading capacitor out at the end of it becomes smaller and smaller, it starts creating a more directional pattern. You could say you start off with a dipole antenna and fold the ends of the dipole toward each other, and you're slowly creating a loop antenna. So there's a fairly strong relationship between a small dipole folded and a loop antenna. So that loop antenna, the halo 6 meter thing, when you drop it, does a pretty good job of transmitting a nearly omnidirectional horizontally polarized signal. North, south, east, and west, my guess is the difference between the angles is probably only a couple of dB. However, that antenna also has a null in its antenna pattern, straight up and straight down, when you're using it that way. So if you wanted to use it as a near vertical incident skywave on 6 meters or 2 meters, that would be a fairly poor antenna. I think that's the question you're asking, John. W2VDH, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, fine business, Dick. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I do remember now one of my friends, this is going back when I was in high school. I remember one of my friends there had put a halo in a rotator and rotated at 360 degrees, and there was very little change in the S-meter signal strength. So yeah, I guess it is omnidirectional in the horizontal plane. Go ahead.
Now, there is an antenna that looks a little bit similar to a loop antenna. It's called a DDRR, Delta Delta Romeo Romeo, Directional Discontinuity Ring Radiator. It looks like a loop. It really is a loop over a ground plane. And that crazy antenna is primarily vertically polarized because it's making a pretty strong E-field between the resonating wire and the ground plane that's under it. And there's a version of it where you lay two of these loops, one above the other, and feed them in opposition. So instead of having a real sheet metal to the ground plane, there's just another one as a mirror image. So that's a loop antenna, which creates essentially vertically polarization. As I said, it's somewhat similar. So as you can tell, loop antennas are very unpopular. I think only 1 or 2% of the amateurs have ever used a loop antenna because they look so small in wavelengths. A loop antenna built at 80 meters as a receiving antenna would only be a couple of feet in diameter. Let me drop. And on 80 meters, if you compare that physically to a full half-wave dipole made out of 14-gauge household wire, which would be 132 feet long. So 132 feet long dipole versus a loop that's a couple of feet in diameter. The average amateur says, gee, it's going to have a very small effective capture area. It's going to be very low in performance. Amateurs believe that. If at the exact same altitude, you put a loop antenna a couple of feet in diameter and compared it to a 132-foot dipole, you would get the exact same performance. Ain't that crazy? The dipole, with good construction, will have reasonable standing wave ratio across the whole 80-meter band. It'll probably hit 3-to-1 standing wave ratio at 3.5 and 4.0 megahertz when you've tuned it for 3750. Whereas the loop antenna with its small dimensions, you QSY with your frequency more than 50 kilohertz, you're going to have to retune that loop or retune the antenna tuner connected to it. Because it's small, it's going to be very high in Q. But as long as you build it out of low-loss materials, it can give you the exact same performance. Because there's a very high voltage across the tuning capacitor at the end, let me drop. You don't want to arc over that capacitor, and that's usually the limiting factor as to how much power you can transmit through the loop. But rather good construction techniques, and with the right kind of materials used for that capacitor, particularly a vacuum variable, for instance, I know you could be transmitting into a so-called receiving loop antenna, and you would get very good performance out of it. Just that everyone believes it's going to be low in performance, therefore they're afraid to try it. The few people who have tried it, and Mel, K2KEY, did build a so-called receiving loop antenna. He was using it in Brooklyn, and he was getting very good performance out of it. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call at us right now, K2REW in the TechNet.
AC2GS.
You've got it, Roy.
I just wanted to say that my first HF antenna was a mag loop. They're fantastic for what they are and how small they are, and that you don't have to put them up very high. But you really, for the most part, mag loops that are made for receiving only usually don't have a tuning network, and the way they get around it is a very high-gain, low-noise preamplifier. And you try and transmit through that, and you'll burn every transistor out of it.
Tell us about your receiving loop, ferrite loop antenna. What frequency range did it cover? What brand name? How many dollars? Roughly how big? Were you using it for AM radio? Did you use it for ham radio on single sideband at 80 and 40 meters? So tell us about it. Assume we know almost nothing because very few of us have that experience with it. And how did you have the leap of faith to go and buy one of those when it's so unpopular, if you know what I mean? You're a progressive guy there again, Roy. AC2GS. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it was a feat of quiet desperation on my part. I had problems getting things on my roof, and so I needed to figure out something that would work simply at 10 feet elevation. And magnetic loops work reasonably well at 10 feet. Some people complain that if you raise them too high, they don't work quite as well.
I bought something called the Pixel Pro 1B. They kind of retired and sold the business to DX Engineering, and DX Engineering is still selling the Pro 1B. I think I was 400 and change. It operated from 80 meters to 10 meters. 10 meters wasn't that hot. As you got lower, it got better and better. I regularly listened to AM broadcasts on it. And it was a very nice, it still is. The preampler, I think, is burnt out. I have to get that replaced. I put it on a rotator. Found that it wasn't really directional. At least, I have it in my backyard, and it's a row of attached houses. So that might be impacting upon its lack of directionality. It's about 3 feet in diameter. It's 10 feet off the ground. And it's a very nice device. I was amazed. I was depressed when I set it up in the shack itself, but when I took it outside, it was very nice.
Question. You said 3 feet in diameter, and you called it a magnetic loop. Now, magnetic loop means the way it tunes. I think there was no real ferrite material in it. Did it have a great big tuning knob? And you said it was made for 80 to 10 meters, but you said you used it on AM radio, which I think means around 1 megacycle. So, got a couple of questions there. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, the way that they sold it was 80 to 10 because it was for amateur radio operators. But it didn't cost me anything. I tuned up on the broadcast band, and it picked up the signal reasonably well. It's their local signal, so it's not that difficult. And magnetic loops don't particularly need anything special. It can have a fixed capacitor. A fixed capacitor will just have a fixed resonance. And then for at least receivers, as you know well, VisWa is very insensitive to receiver front ends. So if you put in a very good preamplifier, you can save a magnetic loop that can't be tuned. But it still operates as a magnetic loop. If you swapped out the fixed capacitor for a variable one and you pulled out the preamp, you could probably use it as a transmitting mag loop.
Does it have a tuning control of any kind? Could you peak it up on a particular frequency you're favoring? Over to you, Roy.
No, it doesn't. It has a completely fixed capacitance. It's just a function of the preamp. I found out that its sweet spot was around 40, and as you went up, it kind of died a bit, but it was difficult to tell because 10 meters wasn't that great when I first got my license anyway. But it kind of peaked at 40. If you look at the bands these days, 40 is the most active, so it could have been just the fact that 40 was more active at that time. I got all the way down to broadcast. I was interested in trying the low frequency, but that's when I found out that my preamp had gotten blown somehow.
Since you've owned that for a while, you probably took it apart and you know it's inside. I think you said it's 3 feet in diameter. Inside, is there a multiple turns of wire of some kind, and then a tuning capacitor across the end, and maybe no tuning capacitor, but maybe the end or some kind of an impedance step-up or step-down device goes into a very high impedance transistorized amplifier. So what's inside of there? And I presume there's no ferrite in there, even though they call it a magnetic loop. Over to you, Roy.
Well, it's my understanding that it's a magnetic loop not because it uses a ferrite. It's a magnetic loop. Some people think of it as preferentially receiving magnetic aspect of electromagnetism. And so their logic is that local electric noises are somewhat shielded from it. So I think that's why they call it a magnetic loop. Other people just call it a shortened dipole, which I tend to think of it as. I never really took it apart because it's built. It's not really built to disassemble. The inside parts, unless you burn them out, I guess. I don't know how you would kill it. The big problem is the preamplifier with some lovely little sensitive FET transistors and such. Those are accessible. But the magnetic loop itself is kind of locked down for the most part.
You said that you didn't see any directional characteristics. I presume you operated the loop perpendicular to the earth, the plane of the loop, and as you rotated that plane and you listened to a particular signal on any one of the frequencies you listened, you didn't see any directional characteristics, Roy? Go ahead.
Not really much. And I kind of invested a significant amount of money on a rotator and a rotator controller because I figured that I was going to null out signals and do all kinds of wonderful things. And I just kept circling and circling trying to find a null, and I, for the life of me, I can't find it. I don't know what, how many micro decibels dip it nulls to, but very, very minimal.
Now, maybe you were looking for a complete null where the signal dropped out. Were you watching your S meter while doing that rotation, Roy?
Yes, that's exactly what I was doing. I wasn't expecting it to null out completely, but I was hoping for a couple of decibels would drop one way or the other. But it just, I didn't see anything.
N2XJN, Wes wants to make a comment. Go ahead, Wes.
I was puzzled with Roy's comment. It was like you have good receiving, but you don't know what is the ESWR. So when you push the transmit button, you're actually hitting mismatch. This is the only way that you can blow the transistor. I cannot see any other way. If you have a match, or perfect match, you cannot blow it. Or correct me if I'm wrong.
No, Wes, it has nothing to do with the VizWire. It has to do that this is a high-gain preamp that's expecting microvolts, not watts.
Yeah, I know darn well you didn't do any transmitting with that antenna. However, you operated that antenna in locations where nearby there was another antenna doing some transmitting. So the possibility exists, as I see it, Droy, and I think you operated this from the roof of your house. It could have picked up some pretty strong signals you radiated with some other antenna and or a local lightning strike. I mean, lightning does happen in Brooklyn, so there's all kinds of ways that an impulse of some kind of energy could get to that high impedance preamplifier. And maybe the preamplifier itself was made out of a low reliability device. A bunch of guesses on my part, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it could have been rain, it could have been snow, it could have been cold weather, it could have been lightning locally. It has a safety switch, so when I'm operating my transmitter, it specifically locks and shuts down the preamp power, so it theoretically shouldn't do that, although I'm sure 1 out of 1,000 times it might have. I'm thinking possibly I have a neighbor who's a block and a half away from me who has a linear amplifier, and I guess it's possible that he was putting a lot of power in, and my preamp was just sitting around and got kind of scared and ran away.
Let me comment one more time.
That's a little bit unlikely, Roy. A block and a half away, even if he's radiating a kilowatt, the first, let me pick a number, the first 100 feet from an antenna, you get a ridiculous number of decibels of fall off of signal, the so-called inverse square law. So for enough signal to be picked up by your loop from a few 100 feet away, being enough to damage that transistor, I'm not saying it's impossible, but if you go to that equation, free space laws, let me drop it. Every antenna obeys this rule. And that is, how much free space loss is there as a function of frequency and distance? Loss in decibels equals 36.6 plus 20 times the log of F in megahertz, frequency, plus 20 times the log of D, distance in miles. And so 100 feet is going to be, 1/100th of a mile, but you can, the equation works all the way down to zero. So you plug in your mileage, your frequency, and the 36.6, and you know the decibels. So I'm guessing if we plug in the numbers for, say, for instance, 40 meters and 500 feet away, you're probably going to find out you've got 40 decibels of loss. Quite often an antenna will give you 90 dBs of decibel in the first mile. So for enough signal to be left over, if you're radiating from the same roof where you are, yes. But a few hundred feet away, I doubt it. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
I wonder if Roy has a schematic of the thread preamp. If it has a serious resonance circuit directly from the antenna, to the ground. It's a loop antenna, so it's quite different, sorry. But that would actually allow a limiter to be installed. But if it's a fed antenna that is feeding from the loop and is through the capacitor giving signal back to the first stage of the receiver, then it looks like this particular antenna doesn't have a limiter for the over voltage, and the over voltage spike could be from anything. Just the electrostatic electricity that is around the antenna. And to achieve.
Yes, you're onto something here, Wes. A well-engineered FET transistor usually has some limiting diodes in its front end, which will give you voltage limitation. I mean, the FET itself, a well-made FET, field effect transistor, quite often has an input impedance of 10 megohms. So when you connect it to an ungrounded circuit, sometimes some ridiculous electrostatic voltages can be picked up. You know, you walk across the wool rug and touch the antenna, a spark jumping from your finger would be destroying the FET transistor. So well-designed FET transistors, just like you're indicating, will have some limiting diodes as front-end protection. And maybe this one didn't have that, or maybe there was a failure along those lines. But on the subject of, let me drop it. On the subject of magnetic loop, the way that antenna works, just similar to the ferrite loop antenna, without a doubt, every electromagnetic wave has got an E field and an H field, a magnetic field and an electric field. And the ferrite loop antenna, 99% of its performance is responding to the magnetic field. If you put a strong E field a pure E field near that antenna, even at the right frequency, it would almost not respond to it. And to call it a magnetic loop makes it sound like there's going to be some ferrite there. Doesn't have to be. And is it responding primarily to magnetic field? I say yes. And how do you make an antenna that responds only to E field? That's more difficult. A dipole, for instance, responds to both. Any further comments on all of the above, Roy? I think when you do further investigation, my guess is the field effect transistor that's in there that's quite possibly damaged is probably today not a very expensive component. And there's various ways with even a digital voltmeter you can test the integrity of that FET, and its replacement of that is not going to be very difficult. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it's on my list of things to do. I mean, hopefully I'll get the antennas on the roof back up also. That's putting a real crimp in my style right now.
Is that because you don't like climbing on your roof and you're looking to hire a person to do that, Roy? The antennas you had on your roof that got damaged by the recent nor'easter, were they put up by you or put up by somebody else, Roy?
What can I tell you? I come from a long line of men who never left the ground. I don't mind step ladders. I don't mind 5 or 6 foot ladders. To get up to my roof is a 40-foot ladder. That I would mind, unfortunately. I would rather not feel that way, but that's the way I feel. I searched and searched and searched for someone for about 3-4 years, and finally I needed to have my roof replaced. So I asked the guys who were coming in for quotes if they would mind just lifting up an antenna that would build completely in the backyard, and they just had to lift it up and just put it down on the roof. And I found more than a few guys who were more than willing. They didn't have the faintest idea what they were doing, but knock on wood, it sort of worked. And about a year or so after that, it kind of tilted over and started to limp along. And I was fortunate that Al and Rich Antuio was mentioning a guy called Leo, who is an amateur radio operator who does this on the side. And so I hired him, and he fixed it up for that time.
Yeah, I think the most natural fear of human beings is the fear of altitude. You can put a a sheet of strong, clear plastic between two tables and put a toddler who's just crawling on one of those tables. And he will not crawl over the edge where he's looking through the clear plastic. As I said, it's built into our genes, a fear of altitude. If we didn't have that, our ancestors would have fallen out of the cave, fallen down the side of the mountain and died, and we wouldn't be here. So the 100-foot tower that I first owned in 1967, it was set up in someone else's backyard. I knew I wanted to buy a 100-foot tower, and I wanted to climb it first. I couldn't do it. The fear was so strong. He took it down in pieces, handed the pieces to me, and brought them into my yard, and slowly started constructing the tower. And it took a step-by-step process of me having the right kind of a harness, a safety harness, wrapped around my body with a lanyard wrapped around the tower, where I slowly built up the lack of fear to be able to climb the tower. So I've been doing all of the construction and maintenance. Let me drop. I've been doing all the construction and maintenance of my 100-foot tower over all these years, and I have a basic fear of altitude. Whenever I do any work more than 60 feet above the ground for more than, say, a half hour, I spend the next two nights having nightmares of falling off a tower, even though I'm always connected at every instant of time with either one or two separate lanyards and harnesses and mountaineering equipment. So I use a lot of safety equipment. So I know where you're coming from, and the smarter people have a fear of altitude because gravity can really get you down. So I guess your roof doesn't need repair right now, and therefore you need another person to do some installation on your roof. So I guess we should put out the word that you're looking for a, you're looking for a rigger to do some roof work on what I think is the roof of, a flat roof of a two-story or a three-story building in Brooklyn in order to repair your antennas. Is that true, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yes, that's true. It's a flat top, two-family, two-story brick house, and I think I have a gentleman to do it. He's kind of, you know, planning that he might make a move or something, so I'm always looking for people who do that because there are very few and they're very, very far between. It's very interesting how, I don't know, nurture versus nature, if you will. I have a niece and two nephews, and my oldest, my niece, I could pick her up and just kind of put her to the ceiling, and she would giggle hysterically. And the middle nephew, if you took him off the ground, he would cry. And the youngest nephew, you could pick him up halfway, he was happy, but anything more than half, he was not happy. So I think it is in the genes, unfortunately.
Well, it's a beautiful safety mechanism that's required because altitude can really do a job on you. By the time you jump out of the second floor window of a house onto the ground, if you were doing that for fire protection or whatever, the chances of doing that without being injured are very, very slim. Okay, I think it's time. We've gone through all the... Let me give one more quick call to Joe. W-E-2-R-Y-Y, who signed in. K-2-R-I-W, are you there, Joe?
Yes, I am here. I had a question for probably more for Paul at the end when he gets near his space report. So it can wait for a while.
Okay, I thank you. We'll hold off for the space report. So now, when it comes to the science and physics report from Roy, we've got dark matter, we've got James Webb, we've got lightning. We can discuss any of the subjects that you would like. The floor is yours, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW, the TechNet. Go right ahead with report number 23.
Oh,
Okay, Dick. Once again, anyone interested, if they want to contact me, if they want to mention a topic or a question or an answer or dispute what I said the week before, just direct it at mailbag@acgs.com. And now something special. This week's episode of Science Talk is sponsored by the Radio Society of Great Britain's exciting new product, Suar Grease. Suar Grease is a patented lubricant that lowers SWR, VSWR, and improves return loss on coaxial cable supplied on the outside of the coax. It dramatically improves your aerial match by making signals slide along the cable with less RF friction, thus improving SWR, VSWR, and return loss. You also get an increased power handling and better talk power because the faster moving signal can build up a greater RF inertia. This gives us at least 9 decibels per kilohertz per meter improvement on single sideband and even more on weak signal modes. Some have reported improvements of up to 12 decibel dB per kilohertz per meter, reducing the SWR up to 3.7. Suar Grease is fully compatible with single sideband, AM, FM, and all digital modes, and even works with legacy modes. This works on all bands from LF to 70 centimeters. So, put Suar Grease on your coax, better matching. Try it today and see how much your system improves. And have a happy April 1st. Anyway, Dick, I think you want to discuss that article that you saw about lightning. Let's try that first.
Very fine. Yeah, Marilyn Vu-Savant, I think is her name. She has an article in the Sunday Today's issue of Parade magazine from Newsday, in which somebody asked her, why does lightning behave in zigzags? And she gave a very logical sounding answer. It's because the resistivity of air is a discontinuous object, and therefore you get zigzags. That's essentially what her answer was. And in my opinion, that's an overly simplistic answer. You dig deep enough, you'll find out that lightning is almost always in zigzags. Each of the individual zigs and zags is in the vicinity of 120 to 150 feet long. So to go that 5,000 or 10,000 feet from the cloud down to ground for a particular cloud-to-ground lightning, and by the way, that's not the most popular lightning. The most popular lightning is cloud-to-cloud or within the cloud. Let me drop. When you talk about a 5,000-foot altitude, you would assume that the cloud builds up enough voltage that it's capable of arcing the air between cloud and ground. And the answer is almost always absolutely not. The dielectric strength of air at sea level is 30,000 volts per centimeter. So if I've got two slightly rounded probes, 1 centimeter apart, and I keep raising the voltage between the two, when I hit 30,000 volts, I'll strike an arc. 30,000 volts per centimeter is 3,000 volts per meter. Well, 5,000 foot altitude cloud, which is probably something like 2,000 meters. 2,000 added to multiplied by 3 million volts per meter, you come up with a huge number, billions of volts. The cloud never has billions of volts. Therefore, the cloud never has enough voltage to arc straight to ground. The cloud has enough voltage to arc air for about 120 feet. So along comes a cosmic ray. The cloud jumps the first 120 or 150 feet and lights up that length of air below the cloud. Then it sits there and waits for a couple of microseconds until the next cosmic ray comes along. This is a theory. The next cosmic ray ionizes a path, and there's a gentle ionization of a path, and then the charged cloud goes through the first 120-foot path, jumps the next 120 feet. So each cosmic ray comes along is at some random angle. And so you'll notice that the upside-down tree-shaped object you get when you get a good photograph of a lightning strike, a typical negative polarity cloud lightning strike, cloud to ground. Let me drop it. You'll see a whole bunch of these zigzags, and quite often there's a number of, there's a trunk and a number of branches, and some of those branches get to the ground, and some of them are unsuccessful. They're all all running in parallel, so to speak, by this process of moving in 120 and 150 foot steps. Each one of those steps is a reasonably straight path, limited by the limited amount of voltage that's available and the fact that you don't have enough voltage to go the whole path, but it's a, but these leader strokes, as they're called, step by step, eventually get to the ground, and then when they do, then you get the real discharge, which is thousands of amperes, and it's usually not just one discharge, it's usually two or three strikes. It's almost like a rapid motion picture, so to speak. You take a high-speed photograph, and you get a flickering effect of the actual full discharge when it happens. So this is a fairly popular theory of lightning. I mean, other than that, it's not easy to describe why does it move in 150-foot steps, why is each individual step essentially a straight line, why are the junctions between the steps at random angles, why are the discontinuous paths, and so on. So this cosmic ray limited voltage phenomenon seems like a good explanation. And it's, I think it goes considerably deeper than just simply saying the air is a discontinuous process. If the air was a discontinuous process, and if that was the only phenomena in action, so to speak, you wouldn't be getting these whole bunch of straight paths 120 feet long with zigzags between them. You'd be getting all kinds of curves and jumps within those individual paths. Lightning tends not to do that. If you own a Wimshurst machine and you look at the arcs you get in a dark room, it's a very interesting structure to study all those individual microscopic zigzags you get in that particular case. Roy brought to my
repeater. Time out.
The very brief theory that I just told you guys about was the subject of a couple of articles that I discovered a few years ago. I wasn't able to re-find them. Roy did find some of those articles or similar articles and presented them to me today. So you maybe have some of your own theories as to what's going on. One of the things to realize that why does air have a specific dielectric strength? By the way, the so-called Passion curve, Mr. Passion, found out when you lower the air pressure, it requires less voltage to arc a particular gap until you get to higher vacuums. A perfect vacuum is a very good insulator. You'll never get an arc without the so-called multi-pactor effect. But 30,000 volts per centimeter, why that magic number? Let me drop it. The ideal gas law has individual air molecules all approximately 3 nanometers apart. And if you draw a straight line between any two air molecules, a random direction straight line, you have to travel roughly 30 nanometers before you encounter another air molecule. So if a cosmic ray comes along, frees up an electron that's in an electrostatic field. You've got these two probes in air. You've got some voltage between the two probes. The voltage creates a certain number of volts per meter. That free electron you just created is now being accelerated. And if the voltage is high enough, he builds up enough velocity in that 30 nanometers on average before he strikes the next air molecule that he now builds up enough velocity that he creates a chain effect. He now has enough velocity to hit the next air molecule where he's able to free up another one or two electrons. Less than 30,000 volts per centimeter, that free electron doesn't get a chance to build up enough velocity. He hits the next air molecule and nothing happens. So that's one possible explanation for why there is a very measurable amount of dielectric strength of air under normal STP conditions. You have to build up enough velocity of the individual free electrons in order to create the chain effect. AC2GS, K2RIW. Where do you stand on all of this, Roy? K2RIW listening.
AC2GS. Well, I'm always amazed at something as primitive as lightning. I mean, you go back in time and just about every sentient life knew what lightning probably was. And yet, don't really know a lot about it. I mean, we know a little bit here and there, but that, as you mentioned, it's a very good theory, but it's a theory because no one can prove it. And there's a whole bunch of people kind of trying to disprove it, that they feel that Cosmic rays don't give the enough of a potential, enough of an oomph to trigger the resulting arc. I think it's kind of immaterial to say about the 150 feet because, as you mentioned, Wilmhurst, the generator, and if you've ever seen these enormous Van de Graaff generators that was used in the 1930s as accelerators, they manifest the same type of branching that occurs. And to me, it's easier to understand it's sort of like a river that meanders. It's going in spurts at the lowest potential energy to get to the next point, and sometimes it can't find the pinching point, and so it dies, and other times it makes it to the ground, and once that ionized trail exists, the ionized trail stays along there for a little while, and the resistance is much, much lower, and so all the electrons that really wanted to get the heck out of the cloud just keep on flashing down, and that's the multiple flashes after the initial ionization. But I think it's a good theory, but unfortunately it's still a theory along with about a dozen other theories.
In the case of a cloud-to-ground lightning, the cloud has some number of megavolts. It doesn't have gigavolts. The cloud never gets that high before something happens to start discharging it. So therefore there's never enough voltage to jump the whole gap between cloud and ground. So it only has the option of going a small amount of distance. And the minor ionization that a cosmic ray can create could be a causative agent. By the way, when you finally do have these liter strokes in 120 to 150 foot steps, on average, that branch their way all the way to the ground after quite a number of liter stroke steps, and you finally ionize that path now discharges the multiple coulombs that are in the cloud down to ground, and in many cases, tens and almost 100,000 amperes can flow. The ionized path through air, when you do draw an arc, is a beautiful example of a negative impedance phenomenon. Let me drop it. If you did strike an arc and you made some careful measurements, you'll find out that as you increase the current through the arc, the voltage drop through the arc decreases. That's what I mean by negative impedance. As the current flowing through the arc increases, you get a larger and larger channel of ionized paths and all running in parallel, so to speak, and the resistance between the two probes goes down. So an arc is a negative impedance phenomenon. As such, when you strike an arc inside of a waveguide because you're using a high-power traveling wave tube, for instance, amplifier on a radar jamming transmitter that's on your aircraft, when you strike an arc, and in many cases, the only way to kill that arc is to turn off the transmitter and wait for the ionized path to dissipate, because that negative impedance phenomena is such that that arc will persist, and the arc itself is running at very high temperatures, tens of thousands of degrees of Fahrenheit, and will burn up all of your hardware if you allow it to persist. So an arc is a very pesky thing. When it comes to opening up switches on your high voltage power distribution systems for transmitting power across the United States, you have to use all kinds of fancy structures that squirt out sulfur hexafluoride across the air path when you open up the gap to open up a switch. Otherwise, the voltage will just arc across the gap and keep right on running, if you know what I mean. So opening up a high voltage 330 kilovolt power transmission line, is not as easy as it sounds. So air arcing is a very interesting phenomenon, and it's that negative impedance phenomenon, explaining it is not extremely easy from time to time. Okay.
Repeater, time out.
Over to you, Roy. What makes you think that the lightning enhancement of the individual leader strokes, what makes you think that that's such a poor theory? How else do you explain the fact that most of these strokes, from cloud to ground, are all very close to the same length? Because the cloud has some number of volts on average before the lightning strike begins, lightning process begins, and therefore there's a limited gap that it's able to move at each one of the jumps. So the limited voltage, the air characteristics, and the cosmic rays, it kind of fits, even though proving it, like you said, is not easy. High-speed photography does go a long way to proving that event, though. AC2GS, K2RIW, the TechNet.
AC, well, high-speed is great for showing you how things develop, like some things that you don't think develop. Sometimes a lightning bolt will come down, and rather than hit the ground, a lightning bolt will pop up from the ground and meet it in midair. So there's a lot of fascinating studies that are doing with high-speed photography. But there's a lot more suggestions. I mean, lightning is actually a crude particle accelerator. There are theories of bounding that near-relativistic velocity electrons bang into nucleuses, knock out a neutron. The neutrons are not very stable. They'll decay into protons, electrons, and anti-electron neutrinos. And they've actually done studies to demonstrate that you have antiparticles along with the ozone after a lightning storm. So there's a lot of interesting theories out there. I don't see how one is definitively the best at this point. We just lack further information.
Okay, since the majority of the leader strokes happen in jumps that are 120 to 150 feet long, other than the explanation that I just sort of quoted to you, what other phenomena would make each of those steps approximately that length, Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW.
Sure. This is King, Baker 2-4, Scott. This is KB2.
No, Dick. Again, it's not like anyone has a great idea that's obviously correct. The problem I have is it might be other factors that are creating that 150-foot phenomenon. As you mentioned with the Wilmers machine, and I mentioned with the Van de Graaff generators, they produce the same branching at smaller lengths. So it might be a function of the some factor, the voltage, who knows, potentials, currents, I don't know. It's usually the fudge factor is to say that the inhomogeneity of the air is causing local low energy points, that it goes, it bursts from one to another to another. So, I mean, you could make a case that one of the reasons why it's at a lower energy is because there are cosmic rays ionizing that little patch of air. So, again, this can devolve into semantics once again, as most interesting scientific conversations, unfortunately, tend to.
The voltage buildup you have on a cloud could be in the vicinity of 450 megavolts. At 3 megavolts per meter, that amount of voltage is capable of arcing air at roughly 150 foot of length. The Van de Graaff generator and the Wimshurst machine have a much, much lower amount of voltage. Therefore, they're only capable of arcing a much smaller length. So therefore, the zigzags you get there are smaller zigzags. So there could be a very strong correlation between the number of volts available on your arc generating process and the distance that each one of the steps of the arc will take. So there seems to be a correlation there, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Okay, I could go along with that. I don't think there's anything special about the theory of cosmic rays that lock you into 150 feet by themselves, unless I'm not aware of it.
The 150-foot limit is because of the 450 megavolts limit. You don't get 450 teravolts into a cloud. There's a whole lot of reasons why a cloud doesn't go that high. Gets more like 450 megavolts. They've made multiple attempts to measure the amount of E-field in a cloud, and they come up with these kind of numbers. That kind of number is capable of arcing air for 150 feet, and that's how big each of the steps seems to be. So there's a reasonable correlation there. Rings become very different, though, when occasionally the cloud builds itself upside down or portions of the cloud get wiped out. If the bottom of the cloud, which usually is negative, happens to be positive, so-called positive lightning, happens to be almost an order of magnitude more severe in the peak current it can create. Occasionally you'll see a lightning storm where each of the thunderbolts is amazingly loud. Quite often those are positive lightning clouds, and those are the ones that are very destructive. There are more people killed by lightning in the United States per year than are killed by hurricanes and tornadoes. So lightning can be very destructive. I think a couple of hundred people per year die in the United States, a couple of thousand people per year in the world die because of being hit with lightning. Those are the people that die. Something like 10 to 1 is the ratio of those who are injured versus those who perish. AC2GS, K2RIW. The bottom line of that is have a healthy respect for lightning. When you're starting to hear lightning over the horizon coming near you, a thunderstorm is building up, the strong recommendation is don't sit in the middle of a wide open field. Don't get under a tree. Find yourself a sturdy building to get into or inside of a metallic automobile. Build, by one means or another, build a Faraday conducting shield around you, because lightning itself is pretty dangerous. Whenever I'm about to climb my tower and if there's any evidence of lightning coming, I certainly don't do that. Even though my tower with all its guy wires is very well grounded, a typical lightning strike is 11,000 amperes. Even if all of that 11,000 amperes is going to be going through the metal rods of my tower, and I'm strapped to the tower with a safety harness, I still don't think that's the right place to be. That local magnetic field that's created, that electromagnetic pulse, I don't want to be that close to it. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
I think annually floods kill more people than lightning, but lightning is a close second. Lightning, again, is fascinating in so many different ways. Positive lightning does produce incredible amounts of discharge power. Some of them can be seen by the space station. There are some very nice pictures of these blue halo effects above the clouds during one of those positive lightnings, and then the ball lightning that probably everyone has heard about, but only recently was even photographed. A lot of people didn't really even believe in them. So it sounds to me that something that nature has offered us this planet for billions of years, and we're still trying to wrap our minds around it.
A typical cloud-to-ground lightning bolt is 11,000 amperes. Occasionally, you get as high as 150,000. Positive lightning has been stated as being able to go as high as 450,000 amperes. It's only for numbers like 20 microseconds, but there's a lot of joules and a lot of kilowatts there. It can create an awful lot of heating damage. They believe the so-called positive lightning is the one that quite often creates fires. Over to you, Roy.
Well, I could believe that, although I'm sure, unfortunately, forests are very dry some seasons, and so it just needs a match to start a fire. But if anything's going to start one, the positive lightning is going to. But like I said, fascinating subject, and it's still available for researchers to do all kinds of studies, because we almost don't have a clue at this point. It's sad to say in some ways, but exciting in others. Who knows? Maybe someone will win a Nobel Prize for answering that question as well.
The National Association of Broadcasters Handbook and a number of other handbooks, the EIA handbook, gives you quite a few recommendations as to how to properly ground a radio tower to protect it and the equipment connected to it for lightning. So there's a lot of history for proper lightning grounding techniques. And so there's a good deal of history there telling you what works 98% of the time, so to speak. Nothing is perfect, but you can protect yourself from, I'm going to pick a number, 97% of the events if you're using the recommended grounding techniques. I know that Eric, KE2EJ, with his broadcast towers, has discussed this with us quite a few times. And there are times when the amount of hardware required to do a proper grounding job to survive that 150,000 ampere strike that will occur is a substantial amount of hardware. Let me drop.
And I have a question.
West recognized something like the Empire State Building and the World Trade Center. I think they get struck a couple of hundred times per year. And that it's very friendly that the those buildings have a very substantial metallic framework grid in the middle of that tower, which does a very good job of grounding the tower itself and everything that's contained inside. There are people who think that you're safe inside of an automobile because the rubber tires insulate the car from the ground. It's not it at all. The metal wire you've got inside that tire is easily arced through by the light. The main thing that protects you inside of an automobile is the fact that you've got a metallic cage around you, a Faraday cage. And under those conditions, the current flows through the outer layers, the skin effect, so to speak, the outer layers of the metal of the car, and doesn't flow through you, the occupant inside the car. So inside of an automobile, with your hands kept hanging out the window, is a much safer place to be in a thunderstorm. Or inside of a good-sized building, particularly one that's got some lightning rods to it. WS2N, K2RIW, Good West.
Yeah, a few things. The lightning occurs when there's a buildup of charge on the clouds and the ground, and it produces electric field that exceeds the electric strength of the air. So then the ionized air is a good conductor and provides path to the air. But instead of thinking 3 times 10 to 6 volt per meter, how about if you think 3 kilovolt per millimeter? When that distance is being ionized, then the next millimeter is quicker to be ionized. And the next millimeter in line is 4 times to be quicker to be ionized. But that's one of the stories. Now, I simply don't understand. Let me jump. So that's how is the lightning is being built. Few other factors that you didn't mention is altitude, air pressure, density, air, and humidity and temperature. So you didn't mention, guys. The pod is also being a part of positive and negative charges that must occur before that. So if we talking about the scientific view of lightning, we must see that what science has agreed to. And the science has agreed to separation of positive and negative charges that must be before that within the cloud for lightning to take place. It also generally agrees that ice might be present within developing stored for eventually form of lightning to happen. A few other things is when we were talking about cloud to ground lightning strikes, that it is rather a form of ladder, step ladder, in length of 550 to 100 meters, and that's what I was talking about, millimeters length. Ionizing faster next millimeter is exactly what is happening in meters with the ladder step ladder lightning strike that starts from negative charges making path to the ground. Let me drop.
The so-called passion curve, which gives you a dielectric strength of air versus air pressure. Let me drop. I did mention that. So a person can look up the word passion, P-A-S-C-H-E-N, I think it is. Let me drop it. The passion curve gives you the dielectric strength of air versus air pressure. So at lower air pressure, particularly if you're building a high voltage power supply that's going to fly in your airplane at 30,000 feet, you have to use better insulating materials because the air will arc over at a lower voltage, at lower air pressure. So air pressure is a big factor. Temperature of the air is a minor factor. Humidity of the air is an extremely minor factor. That's the very opposite of common sense. I will admit that when you're hardware on a cold winter day where everything is dry, it's easy to build up an electrostatic charge on your rug and on your doorknob, so to speak, when the air is dry. But the actual arcing of the air itself is very insensitive to humidity, only minor sensitivity to temperature, major sensitivity to air pressure. Your theory about it should only move a millimeter at a time. The very first step, the very first millimeter, may be so. But if you've got a cloud that's sitting there,